Bloomberg. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me today.
Tom, great to be back with you.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And you know, you and I always seem to be speaking about the, let's say, ramifications of acute situations. Some of the news events that you and I have discussed because we were already scheduled to speak and something happens right before, like the Nord Stream pipeline attack, for example, or the 12-day war, things like that. But I want to take a bit of a step back today and try to understand and talk through things from a broader perspective. What do you think the world looks like in, let's say, 10 years from now, from either an economic power or even compartmentalization perspective, like the rise of the BRICS, for example? Do you think that the world looks materially different than it does today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Across many dimensions. I think in the development of AI, 10 years is 50 generations. Mm-hmm. Who knows where AI will be in 10 years? I could tell you that through my own participation in the private markets, working with some AI startups, just to see the power of the tools that are available for free for anyone in the world to use. You know, when the internet was first rolled out, there was all this talk about how every genius in the world would now be discovered, you know, because MIT had put its full curriculum on the internet for free for everybody to use. This is truly the democratization of technology. You know, for those that aren't like in the weeds on this, and we'll talk obviously about more than AI, but that's the first thing that jumped into my head when you asked your question, just because of the pace of change of the technology in that space and the consequences of it. There are enormous numbers of incredibly well-trained models for free in the open source that anybody can download, and then to run inference on those models, which means to actually use them, costs next to nothing. And every day, more and more powerful trained models and other tools are deployed to the open source, which are then, you know, leaped upon by hives of bees, tweaking with them, using them, doing cool things with them, making them better. And it's just this ecosystem of unfettered creativity, and unfettered in a bad way too. I mean, there's no guardrails at all that I can see on the open source. And so just from the AI perspective, what's already been done, just taking full advantage of that, will result in a pace of technological change that is unrecognizable to you and me, and I would suspect the vast majority of the people who will listen to this. But then beyond AI, it's very clear that the current Western system has to go away, has to undergo an earthquake, a fourth turning, if you will. Mm-hmm. We're watching the fallout from, you know, the various file releases and the political earthquakes that are rumbling around the world. We're keeping a close eye on Britain this morning, which is something that we've been interested in for some time. The debt levels are unsustainable. The fiscal situation is unsustainable. You know, U.S. stock market valuations are incredibly unsustainable. And so, you know, how we get from here to there is very interesting. You know, when we look at the senior levels of the U.S. leadership today, we still see people in their 70s and 80s and even 90s clinging on to power. All that's going to be wiped away here soon. And so then the last thing I would say, aside from sort of AI literally probing what it means to be human, and the financial system that we've all grown up in for the past five decades dissolving away, and the third major change is we are clearly on the path from unipolarity with US at the middle to a temporary period of multipolarity with the US, Russia, and China competing, to within 10 years, China sitting as the unipolar power in the world. And I think that trajectory is undeniable. And those who do deny it are naive. The Chinese have dominated all the things that matter when you're talking about geopolitical power for some time, and they're just now beginning to flex their escalation dominance across multiple levers of power. And we can't imagine that that doesn't continue, accelerate, and ultimately break through. There's only so much resistance that the ebbing empire of U.S. hegemony can exert over China. And I think that's coming to a head as well. Let's just hope that within the next 10 years, we don't see a full nuclear exchange, because then, everything else is kind of moot.
Well, as we saw on a recent Epstein Files dump, I think World War III is supposed to start on the 8th, right?
Yeah, let's pray it doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously there's a million places to go from there, but the one thing that really piqued my interest as you were explaining that is the idea that, let's say, the 70, 80, and 90-year-olds that are clinging to power within the US are going away and possibly very soon. What do you mean by that?
Well, Mitch McConnell can barely walk. And Trump is approaching 80. I don't know how old he is. Limited by the Constitution, can't run again. Remains to be seen, I suppose.
But it's not like there's, a fresh new crop of young, hopeful, full of potential people that are going to replace the older generation.
That's part of the problem. Many of the potential talents have been suppressed or have been so discouraged from running for office because of the filth that emanates from Washington, D.C., the slime, the grime, the corruption, the grift. The disparity between the success you can enjoy in the private markets versus the pub in the private job sector, sorry, versus the public sector. And frankly, the fact that you have to be unethical to ascend in politics, I think that's kind of table stakes at this point, has driven away a lot of talented people from office. And so what replaces these, board members of the AARP remains to be seen. Again, another input into the uncertainty that's coming. But you're right. There isn't much in the way of, John F. Kennedy isn't walking through that door, right? Maybe remains to be seen, but it can't be that Nancy Pelosi is still a thing in 10 years. Politically, I mean.
So, as a, let's say, as an extension of that Western power, obviously there's a lot of different branches of that power, but I think the US dollar being, such a ubiquitous tool through the world, what do you think that looks like in a decade? And I guess we can kind of take the previous decade of performance of the USD, and let's say percentage of usage through the world, as an indication of that.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of confusion about this subject. I mean, you have to partition your analysis between, the dollar as a currency and treasuries as a reserve asset. And I think, obviously, depending on the maturity of the treasury bond or bill, the closer it is to maturity, the more money it is. One is sort of the typical way to look at these things. And it is just undeniable, beginning with North Korea and Iran, and then in a significant escalation with Russia, that the neutrality of US treasuries is gone. And part of what made the US dollar such a successful reserve currency for so long was that you can transact in US dollars and then park your excess reserves in treasuries, which were the functional equivalent of dollars, deepest liquid market, all that stuff. And you wouldn't have to worry about political risk. It was neutral. And that's just no longer the case. The escalation in the use of sanctions to achieve political means leads to the conclusion that U.S. treasuries are no longer neutral. That's just, I don't think that's a deniable observation. There are still huge moats to the U.S. dollar system, and plenty of people can better describe those moats than me. But the Chinese and the Russians and the Indians and the many of the governments of the Middle East and some in Latin America are actively working to circumvent the sanctions aspect of the US dollar system, which by necessity means that when these workarounds are implemented, and they will be, the other aspects of what made the US dollar so strong as a global reserve currency will be chipped away as well. So I think we're seeing, as part of a multipolar world, you have a bifurcation or a trifurcation of trading systems, and there will be lines of communication between the centers of power. But it's not like China's going to stop buying Russian oil or Russian wheat because, Janet Yellen and Scott Bessent said they shouldn't. The wheat and the oil is more important than the dollar. The dollar is the vehicle, the medium by which those transactions are meant to be efficient and smooth. If you take actions to increase the friction of such transactions, especially the critical ones like energy and food, then you are proactively laying the groundwork for the demise of the dollar. We wrote a piece back in early 2022 when the war broke out and they went for the Russian reserves. I believe the piece was called On the Brink of an Economic Singularity, something to that effect. A singularity in physics is an event horizon, the other side of which can't be predicted because the laws of physics break down at that event. And we believed that the freezing of the Russian foreign assets was a singularity moment because you just can't come back from it. Now, what it means back then was difficult to predict, but we knew it was meaningful. And here we are, 4 years later. One of the most interesting stats, which we don't think is a coincidence, is the uplift in Russia's gold holdings. The value of those gold holdings, as measured in US dollars, has more than offset the value of the seized assets. And we just don't think that's a coincidence.
And what a, let's say, what a strategic way to shore up your economic might.
Well, more pertinent to the discussion. And sort of yes, and what a obvious demonstration of the value of gold as the neutrality of treasuries abates. Gold is nobody's credit, right? I mean, if especially if you're in possession of it, it's not like Russia has its gold stored in London. At least I don't think they do. And so, gold is a great place to park. Excess returns, much greater than whatever Russia had parked it in, because they're sitting in Euroclear, frozen, and various other places, whereas Russia still has its gold. And so, if you're the head of central bank of pick your favorite petro state, I mean, are you going to park it in treasuries, or might you diversify a little bit into gold and maybe even, RMB?
As you're explaining the idea of smooth and efficient transaction or trend, yeah, transaction ability that the USD has facilitated, the SWIFT system is, seemingly such an outdated and archaic system. But yet, over its existence, it has yet to be replaced in a meaningful way. How do we actually, like, what do you think catalyzes change in a legacy system like that?
Oh, I think it's happening now. I think the Chinese have rolled out various products that people are using in massive quantities that's just being underreported. Again, pennies don't hold up dollars for very long, pun intended. Currencies are mediums of exchange. Look, there is no money today. We've said this many times. There's no single entity that performs all three aspects of money, medium of account, a certain medium of exchange, unit of account, and store of value. The US dollar doesn't store value, so it's not money. You can't buy things with gold, so it's not money. But currency, so the US dollar is basically a currency. It's not money. It's not even money. It's a currency. And currencies are useful to the extent that they facilitate frictionless trade. And if the US dollar doesn't facilitate frictionless trade, it will be replaced because humans need to trade. And so it was always a perversion of the power dynamics to assume that the US dollar was so powerful that it could trump oil and food in global trade. It just won't. People will go to war before they'll let that happen. And then that's what we unfortunately might be seeing.
So again, kind of stepping back and taking this longer view, do you think that Trump's move over Venezuela and possible move to take over Greenland end up making a material difference in both the energy and mineral markets?
Well, we're of the view that the long-term real price of all commodities is lower. And Trump's move in this regard with Venezuela in particular is consistent with that, because if the regime left behind does play ball with Trump, and so far it looks like they are, then a country that used to produce 4 million barrels a day and now produces one will again produce more. And but as well as the ultimate embodiment of our view that politics is far more constraining to the production of oil than geology. And so, to Trump's credit, look, I think the operation was wholly illegal, shocking, comes with all manner of dangerous precedents. If might is right, you better be right about the might of your opponents. And one of the things we see in Washington is that they routinely underestimate the might of their opponents. So the precedent could be used by other mighty countries to execute similar operations against countries that the US might want to see such operations executed against. However, back to the specifics of the situation, to Trump's credit, as far as regime change operations go, this one was pretty clean. It's not the mess that Iraq became, that Libya became, that Syria has become so far. Knock on wood for the people of Venezuela. It was a surgical operation that left a government in place, but reoriented its priorities, let's say, to sort of speak euphemistically about it, in a way that sure looks a lot better than, say, what Hillary Clinton did in Libya. So far. So we'll see. It's too soon to tell, but it is a, it's only Trump, you know? What can I say?
Well, I want to get into a little bit later the idea of, how consequential one particular president can be. But before we get there, I want to take another perspective, this longer term perspective on change. What is your view on, let's say, the reign of Trudeau and now Carney's particular role as Canadian Prime Minister? Canada ranks first in uranium, first in potash, second in nickel, third in oil, fifth in gold, and first in fresh water. And yet it seems like our powers that be, miss, quote unquote, miss every opportunity to develop and harness our resources. Do you think that there's more to understand here from that long-term perspective of what the ultimate goal is with Canada and possibly the US?
Yeah, as in our view, look, I mean, this is a loaded question. And we have some thoughts on it. Not all thoughts find their way to our masthead, of course. And we think it has far less to do with the United States, for example, than it does, say, with Great Britain. Canada is still a Commonwealth country. The influence of the British monarchy over Canada and Canadian politics is still quite pronounced. If underreported within Canada and underappreciated by the average Canadian. And there's long-standing historical gripes within Canada that are just barely below the surface most of the time, mostly because the CBC and other broadcast outlets get their money from the government, and then the government would like to keep them slightly below the surface. We all know what I'm talking about. And one of the major gripes, of course, is that Western Canadians feel as though they have been exploited by the Eastern elite, and that, as we've written about on several occasions, I mean, the people of Saskatchewan should be amongst the wealthiest in the world, given the relatively small size of their population and the giant size of their resources that the world needs and wants, and frankly can't live without. And so that equilibrium has to be reached eventually. To our American subscribers who don't know that much about Canada, they're surprised to learn just how unsettled Canada's Confederacy actually is, and how recently borders have changed within Canada, and how soon they might change again. Is it really natural that Alberta and Saskatchewan aren't the same province, for example, just to give you one? I think if you read history, it wasn't necessarily meant to be that way. They have a lot in common culturally and historically. Is Quebec really comfortable inside of Canadian Confederacy? What to make of the Maritime provinces? Does Ontario have disproportionate power relative to what it contributes economically, politically, culturally to the rest of Canada? The whole question of the treatment of the native peoples is somewhat unresolved, more so, say, in British Columbia than in other parts of the country. And so there's an awful lot up in the air. And you have a country that has, what, 40 million people now? And has, its resource is basis on par with Russia's. It should be far wealthier. So your question about Carney and Trudeau, we called Carney's rise because we know Canadian politics, and more importantly, we understand British and Canadian propaganda quite well, especially for American-based analysts. And we could see that the writing was on the wall, that Carney was being positioned for the job. Now, when you say things like that, people assume that you're being conspiratorial. But if we could see that Carney was going to replace Trudeau and win the election before he was a contract you could bet on Polymarket, it can't be that we were just lucky, right? Like you recognize patterns and you know what propaganda is, and you see the puff pieces in the various newspapers and magazines being strategically positioned. And you could see that this former banker of the head of the Bank of England and the head of the Bank of Canada, with Goldman Sachs on his resume and Harvard on his resume, and sitting as chair of the board of Brookfield Asset Management, that he was clearly being positioned to replace Trudeau. And look, to the credit of whoever decided that Carney should be prime minister, he's a far more formidable intellect than Justin Trudeau. So for whatever reason, it was decided that the post of prime minister needed to be occupied by somebody with more intellectual heft at a critical time, where it was decided that Alberta's energy needed to be unstuck, and only a dyed-in-the-wool liberal like Carney could stare down the climate movement in the same way that only Nixon could have opened up China. And that's what Carney's been doing. And I think if you go back and read our piece in December of 2024 called Alberta Clipper, and then see what has transpired since, you can then go and read our follow-up piece in April called The Fix Is In. You could see that, Canada's not this wonderful representative democracy where your vote really counts. It just isn't. I'm sorry if that is a shock to some of your listeners, but it's just not how Canada works.
So to come at that a little bit more directly, do you think that they're, or what do you think of the possibility of, let's say, the US trying to take over Canada, and or let's say Alberta separating and or becoming part of the US? Like, are those possibilities that you're entertaining at this point?
Well, our mental model, as published in those articles, was that a fake constitutional crisis would be needed to truly unstick Alberta's energy, and that nothing is more unifying than somebody to hate. And Orange Man Bad plays to all of the major insecurities of the typical Canadian, the overbearing cultural gorilla that is the United States, and reacting to American cultural overbearance is a visceral thread of Canadian culture. Stop me if I'm saying anything that you disagree with. And so, could there be a more uncouth character to portray in the Canadian propaganda machine than Donald J. Trump? And so, we note with interest, for example, that the little mini boomlet of stories about the treasonous act of the Alberta separatists for having the audacity to speak with Americans about what a post-Canada Alberta might look like. We think this is all sort of phony, and that you need this fake constitutional crisis in order to convince those in Eastern Canada who have been so sold on climate change that, yes, those pipelines need to be built. And that's still what we think is happening. We hold on to our mental models until they stop working. Once they stop working, we discard them, of course, and try to ponder new ones. But our original mental model that Carney would be installed to unstick Alberta's energy using Orange Man Bad as the justification to wipe away climate hysteria is still working, 14 months later.
As we think about Orange Man Bad and the impact that he had from 2016 to 2020, and obviously, 25 to let's say 29 here. Is he, let's say, as consequential as a president like Nixon or Eisenhower? Or is that more so a, do you think it's a function of the times rather than the particular person that is quote unquote in power at that point?
Yeah, so I'm going to say things that are sure to annoy everybody. We like to say that Trump is everything his biggest fans and fiercest critics say he is, which is, we think, the best way to understand the phenomenon that is Trump. Look, Trump is an extraordinarily consequential figure. Love him or hate him. And he is an extraordinary political talent. He, whether you think he's the biggest phony in the world, or you think he is the second coming of you know who, nobody can deny that the man won the Republican nomination for president three times, despite being hated by the Republican establishment. And he won the election two times, he would say three. His election in 2024 must go down as the greatest political comeback in US history. And so he is a phenomenon. And in that narrow characterization, that there's something very consequential going on. Now, seems to be struggling a bit here with his base for a variety of reasons. History will determine how he is ultimately remembered, but he is a giant of huge consequence, domestically within the US and on the international stage. And so, but he is all the things. Like, he is the guy who hires Chris Wright and wants to uncork a US energy revolution and a nuclear renaissance, and also the guy who did Trump University. He's that guy too. He's the guy who launched Trump Coin 3 days before his inauguration. I mean, so he's Donald Trump.
And I guess we'll see what the cinematic event of the year or the decade is going to be when the Melania film comes out as well. And it'll be interesting to see the
I think it's out, isn't it?
That shows you how much I've been paying attention to it, I guess.
I have not seen it. I don't intend to. But I think it's out because I saw on Twitter that there's some controversy about how the reviewers are giving it 12 tomatoes and the fans are giving it like 98 or something like that, you know, as you might expect.
Interesting. Well, that kind of brings me to an interesting point that I also wanted to talk to you about is, let's say, the way that information is controlled, disseminated, shaped, distorted, and how that plays into the narrative shaping and also the, let's say, the consequentiality of people's actions. How do you think the information that most people get at this time affects their actions? And maybe we can use the beginning of the Ukraine conflict that you recently wrote about as an example of that. You know, we saw when that began, we saw the violent explosions that were shared and seen millions of times on Facebook and other social media sites. And yet it turned out that those weren't actually from the Ukraine.
Sure. Yeah. We wrote a piece called Fit to Print, where that was the opening story. Something we give a lot of thought to because we're in this business now. And we note with interest that yesterday, you know, as we're recording this, 200, 300, 400 reporters of the Washington Post have been laid off. You know, there's much hand-wringing on social media from certain side of the political aisle about what a disaster this is. We would argue that it is testimony to the failure of legacy media to maintain the trust of their audience. We think the rise of Substack is a direct consequence of that failure to maintain the trust with their audience that the legacy media has done. And how did the legacy media find itself in this position? Well, month after month after month of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You know, pick your favorite war of convenience that the mainstream media has supported wholeheartedly. The raw politicization of straight news. And so the legacy media has lost its way. And in the piece Fit to Print, we took a very recent event, which is this very temporary energy ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia, which all facts seem to indicate Trump requested from Putin and Putin obliged. We then took that event and went around the world and showed you how five different countries reported it, just to give you, the reader, a look at how propaganda works around the world. And because legacy media has failed so poorly, it has become incredibly challenging for the average person who doesn't do this for a living to get a true sense of what's actually going on. And, you know, poorly intended political actors proactively take advantage of this time and time again. British propaganda is the worst. We showed a prime example of it in the piece. And anytime we write about certain topics, we get a few pieces of hate mail from people who live in Britain because they're just swimming in such propaganda that it's understandably difficult for them to perhaps read something that is a wholly different perspective on the same events than the one they've been fed. And so this is an existential question for how society is currently wired. Back to the very first answer to the very first question you asked me, which is AI is making this all the more difficult.
Exactly.
Look, just the release of these files, Twitter's unusable.
Ugh.
Half of what I've seen is just outright fake AI generated manipulation. And who knows who's doing it and why? Oftentimes the guilty do such things just to muddy the waters. You know, early in my life, I wish I hadn't done it. I went down the rabbit hole of the JFK assassination. And I probably read several hundred books, or several dozen books at least, more than 100 books. And I saw a pattern emerge, which is damning information would be released in the form of a book. And it would hook you in, and you would read the book, and you think, wow, I'm reading something very interesting. And then they would throw in a hot piece of stinking garbage that was obviously made up nonsense. And then that piece of garbage would be pointed to discredit the whole book, and therefore discredit the actual interesting piece of information that might be damning, to say that the whole thing was just malarkey, to quote former President Joe Biden. And I saw that over and over and over again. So then you begin to ask yourself, well, who are the authors of these books? Were the publisher of these the publishers of these books? Like, what? How did this get into print? So, like this article that we quoted in Fit to Print about from Britain, like we didn't say it in the piece. Go look at who wrote that. Go look at that person's history. Huh, that's interesting. Why is the Telegraph printing this? Once you start to ask those questions, well, it's a slippery slope, and the risk in doing so, which is why I express some hesitation or perhaps lament at having gone down the JFK rabbit hole, is it does tend to make you pretty cynical.
Well, cynical, but also gives you a better understanding of how information,
Yeah.
again, is controlled, and what gives you a better sense of what information is useful. And the reason I asked this question is because, I was looking at a recent article in 19 or from 1991 of the fall of the Soviet Union, and there were hundreds of thousands of protesters that showed up demanding change. And it makes me wonder if the control or if the way that this information is controlled is in some way responsible for the, let's say, ability of the powers that be to avoid massive protests like that. And let's say an action by a population to try to affect that type of change.
Yeah, well, that's a fascinating question, isn't it? So let's take the other side of this. The whole color revolution tactics, right? So what happened in Iran a couple of weeks ago was very fascinating to us. We've not written about it. Not sure we have anything to add to it. To us, looked from the outside like a classic color revolution attempt by Western intelligence agencies. And we note with interest that the thing that Iran did, that the thing that Iran, the thing that the current leadership of Iran did that quelled the protests and cemented their grip on power was they shut down the internet. And most shockingly to the Western intelligence agencies was they managed to shut down SpaceX, Starlink. Well, that kind of tells you something, doesn't it? Tells you what Starlink is. Tells you what other governments think Starlink is. The fact that it seems like the Russians gave the technology to the Iranians to do that tells you that the Russians were investing in that technology. All manner of Starlink stories coming out of Ukraine and Russia right now, as well, which I'm sure you're aware of. And so if the internet is used by Western intelligence agencies. And I, if you follow the work of Mike Pence on Twitter, I think it's pretty undeniable that there's a pattern of this going back decades. And the internet was what the Iranian authorities shut down in order to stop that from happening. Then the same people who were trying to use the internet to sow political upheaval in foreign countries controls this internet, the one you and I use. And they're in power here. And so that tells you then, look, we're watching this European attack on X with great interest. Yeah. I'm sure you've seen this. But Prime Minister of Spain, Sanchez, And in France, apparently they raided the offices of X, and not necessarily the world's biggest fans of Elon Musk, but at the same time, this should be viewed as a conflict between Europe and the US, because that's what it is. But that's interesting to us. We thought Europe was at war with Russia.
Seems like they're at
So,
war with everyone.
with very little in the way of weapons, huh? Other than regulations. So yeah, it's fascinating to see. Again, but the thing about it is, like, we have these mental models that work, but we often say that the axioms that form the foundation of your mental model need not be correct. They just need to work. But we don't know what's correct. We just know what's currently working, which is both useful and frustrating at the same time, because we're not nobody's telling us, right, what the big secret is behind the closed doors. But we'll see. The attack on X and Telegram, they arrested the founder of Telegram in France, remember?
Right.
If Europe does not have its own social media companies, it doesn't have, look what one of the things that's interesting is we always look at what the Chinese government is doing as a tell for what's actually going on. And I traveled to China a fair bit back when I was in industry. You couldn't use Twitter or Facebook in China unless you had VPN, I suppose. I would never use them because the last thing I wanted to do was break any law when I was a privileged guest of the Chinese government in their territory, because the last thing I wanted to find myself in was a Chinese jail. I would not do well in a Chinese jail, just for the record. But like, they banned these things long before the rest of us really knew what they were. Chinese knew what they were from day one and kept them out of their country. Europeans did not do that, of course. Europeans allowed X and Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and everything else to infiltrate their borders and to saturate their borders. So yeah, it's fascinating for us to see. And so, does X pull out of Britain, France, and Spain? Does Telegram? We'll see.
Back to your point about the muddying of the waters, there was a couple of recent posts on X, and I mean, as much as I try to help inform my listeners about things that are happening, I find X almost unusable. So the particular example was there was a tweet, let's just call it whatever it's called now, about this giant short position that was opened in silver. And a couple hours later, I went back on, and there was basically the exact same wording, the same chart, or same colored chart, basically full, pulled from the same charting service. And it was the exact same thing, but just in Bitcoin from a completely different account. And there was a couple zeros added to it. And that's one example of many, many examples that I look at and just think my addition to this noise is completely useless and I want to stay out of it. And maybe that is the best way to go about actually controlling Twitter is to muddy the waters in such a way that it makes people stop wanting to engage with it.
So we have our own set of tactics, which I'm happy to share. We use Twitter exclusively via lists. So we curate lists. We have a list of those on the left and those on the right, and what they're saying to each other is very interesting. There's lots of people contributing on Twitter. I just call it Twitter. It'll always be Twitter. That aren't political, that aren't trying to trick people. Like, there's genuine experts sharing interesting things that the algorithm doesn't pick them up because the algorithm is optimized for clicks. But you can still make lists of these people, and you could curate those lists based on credibility. And somebody who's wildly uncredible is actually as interesting a data point as somebody who is. I mean, you just have to know what you're looking at. The old Kramer as a contraindicator. Kramer is very
Okay.
useful. Pelosi as a stock picker, right? I mean, these memes are funny for a reason.
Funny and useful.
Yeah, right. And so we have curated, because again, Twitter is unmatched for real-time data. Some of that data is signal and most of it is noise. And to the extent that it is useful to develop the skill of partitioning signal from noise in the sea of data that bombards Twitter, we have tried to do that. So I'll give you one example of something. And by the time this airs, it'll either look like a great call or it'll look like a silly call. But who cares? I'll just say it. Was perusing Twitter last night. I told you we have an interest in the sustainability of the current British government. We have written about it a few times, and we've made the long shot prediction that Ed Miliband will replace Keir Starmer, not quite with the same certainty that we made the Carney call. By the way, Carney, Alberta Energy, that's why Doomer cares about it. Miliband, the king of renewables, that's why Doomer cares about it. Like, there's a tie to energy here. We're not like a political newsletter, but you have to understand politics to understand energy. So back to the story. The whole Epstein files drop, and this Mendelsohn character is at the center of the melee in British politics. And we watch people from all sides of the spectrum, and we watched with great interest, George Galloway's scathing monologue. I don't know if you know this George Galloway character, sort of a left-wing politician of some controversy in Britain. But and then we watched this clip start to go viral on Twitter of Starmer in question period, which is sort of a, as a Canadian, you would know what question period is. It's a standard sort of a iconic aspect of the British parliamentary system that the prime minister stands for questions from the opposition and tries his or her best to answer them.
I was going to say, tries his or her best to completely deflect and not answer them.
Sure, some are better at that than others. And Starmer failed miserably last night. He was asked a question about whether, Epstein was brought up in the Mendelsohn due diligence, because of course, for those that don't know, Mendelsohn was appointed by Starmer to be the, ambassador to the United States, Britain, a controversial pick at the time, and turns out now a disastrous one. And Starmer's answer sort of shocked the British Parliament. And in that moment, you're thinking, man, this guy has an 11% approval rating. And he can't survive this crisis. And so I saw that. To me, that was a real signal. Okay, but there's a point to this story. I immediately went over to Polymarket, and I just typed in Starmer out by to see if there was a contract. To be fair, I knew there was because I looked at this contract earlier in 2025. And at the time that I looked at it, Starmer out by December 31st, 2026. Yes, could be bought for 56 cents. Now, I don't have a Polymarket account. I don't think it's legal in my state. Not investment advice, but I'm very fascinated by Polymarket because it sort of offers a chance for people to express a view on geopolitics. And so I looked it up, and it was selling for 56 cents, which means that if Starmer resigns or is forced out before the end of the year, you get paid a buck. And 44 divided by 56, a pretty good return. And so we posted it on Notes on Substack. I said, wow, December, yes, is only 56 cents. It wasn't a recommendation. It was just an observation of a contract that seemed to have been mispriced. Now it's the next day, and you and I are talking, and that contract's up to 63 cents. We'll see where it is by the time this podcast publishes. But you could see how Twitter moves at a speed that I think it gives you an edge. I remember in the early days when Doomberg was on Twitter, FinTwit was a big thing. We were contributing to FinTwit, and you'd see news about a stock proliferate across Twitter, and the stock wouldn't move, and it would seem like important news. And then you'd see the red headline cross on Bloomberg. For those that have a Bloomberg terminal, you know what I'm talking about. And then the stock would move. And like in the day of the era of high frequency trading and hedge funds and arbitrage firms and momentum shops, Twitter still beat the Bloomberg terminal time and time and time and time again. And so I think Twitter's strength is its weakness. Like, you can see this silver chart and Bitcoin chart and know it's BS because you're skilled in the art of consuming Twitter. You have to be. Whether the average person is or not, of course, depends on their need and their practice and their experience. And then assuming that people are fooled all the time, does that still give governments the right to regulate it or to ban it? You know what I mean? Like, shouldn't people learn to pass the Turing test of authentic news versus fake BS, like, at some point? Because you're going to confront it everywhere. It's not just on Twitter. And that's going to be a real thing with AI, as we mentioned. And so, yeah, it is what it is. So we'll see. By the time this comes out, if Starmer has resigned, then that will have looked like a quite a prescient call.
Absolutely. Going back to the idea of passing the Turing test of BS and the idea of the BS charts, let's say, of silver and Bitcoin, as you mentioned. How do you think people need to learn from charts that are going vertical like that to take profits and to stay
Yeah.
out of that narrative?
It's a great question. And look, I'm not a trader. I don't give investment advice. I was on a podcast last week, Maggie Lake's podcast. It was live. It's always kind of fun to do. She's great. Love Maggie. And silver was mooning. It was like 110. And gold was mooning. And I disclosed that day I took about a third of my gold position off in the 5500s. Still have my core position. Wish I'd sold more in hindsight, but who knows? Hindsight is 2020. Never owned silver, but I did say in that podcast, as my friend Tony Greer would say, if you don't sell into strength, when will you sell? Or alternatively, high five with one hand and make a sale with the other. I tend to want to sell Icarus prints, and an Icarus print when you see it. But at the time that silver was reaching 110, Twitter is just filled with silver to 200, 500, 2000, 10,000 memes. And we've all seen we've seen this before. Jared Dillon famously uses social media as a contrarian indicator, and I think he does quite well for himself doing that. And so, like, those types of moments are rare. And if you were a silver stacker buying it in the 30s and it's trading at 110 and you didn't sell at least some of it, when would you sell? So, for example, back to gold, right? Like, I own gold as a hedge, predominantly against, debasement. But I don't own enough gold that if the US went into hyperinflation tomorrow, I wouldn't be materially negatively impacted by that. I mean, the most of my net worth is in US dollars. I transact in US dollars. I have a fair bit of gold relative to the average person, but not enough to fully insulate generations of my family, right? And so, is the US dollar system going to collapse overnight? Probably not. Does gold going from 5,000 to 5,600 in 4 days tell me that's probably time to make a sale? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good lesson to keep in mind, and a good ho hopefully an idea that you as in the listener can remember going forward from volatility like this that we have really seen over the last little bit.
And look, I didn't sell all my gold. It's not like I picked the top, but you can see, I'll give you another example. Natural gas spiked huge on cold weather. And I was in a private chat with some people and friends, and talking about how this might be a time to fade natural gas. And what I said was, if you think there's going to be a summer in 2026, this is getting a little out of hand. There's an enormous amount of natural gas in the US, and you might want to fade this. Never would have imagined that, natural gas would drop 20%. The March contract would drop 20% on Monday, like it did. But you could tell, like, okay, this is getting out of hand. I couldn't make the trade because I was not at my computer, but I was looking on my phone when silver collapsed, that 30% dive. I think it was turned out some leverage ETF blew up or something. I don't know. I wasn't following it that closely. But you could see that gold was really tanking, sort of in a sympathy dive with silver. And if I was at my computer, I would have bought back what I sold. I'm an old person. I still like to make trades on my computer, yes. Because I just think, like, wow, that doesn't make sense for gold to be down 1,100 bucks because silver's down. And I might have tried to catch that falling knife. I didn't, so I'm not, again, but, and again, I'm not a professional trader, but if you can't sell silver at 110, it's just like, when would you sell? I'm very fascinated by the AMC dynamic. One of the things we've seen in the post-COVID era, the memification of stocks, is a small group of very, very emotionally bought in group of investors are convinced of a certain narrative about Wall Street. AMC apes, GME, you name it. Uranium has a bit of that. Silver has a bit of that.
I almost want to say it's they're not necessarily silver or uranium investors. It's more like, or AMC investors. It's more like hodlers.
Yes, they're members of a social construct. Diamond hands, toilet paper hands, all that stuff. You know what I'm talking about. And so I'm fascinated by that mindset. Matt Levine has written about this brilliantly many times. Dimitri Kofinas, I believe, coined the phrase market nihilism to describe it. So whenever I see, like, silver again, you see the celebrations on Twitter. It's usually a sign, right? I mean, like, I had a friend who reached out to me. Again, it's an entrepreneur with whom I invested in one of his companies, and he's like, "Yeah, what do you think of the silver?" And I was like, "Wow, that's the type of question you get near the top, right?" And I said to this person, I think silver was like 105, 110. So look, if silver's not materially lower by April, I'll be shocked. Because, like, all shortages lead to gluts. Silver's a commodity. There's a lot of silver. There's a lot of junk silver in the world. Whenever you see these Icarus prints, look out below. Now I think gold is different. Gold's not a commodity. Stock to flow, all that stuff. But people still kind of treat it like a commodity sometimes. And so when I saw gold going down violently because silver was going down violently, that didn't feel right to me. But I was like, yeah, when you see that pattern of spiking of footballs, I don't know, it just happens so regularly that it's almost hard to imagine it not happening at some point, right? I mean, like, silver's not going to 500. And if it does, if the higher silver went, the quicker it would return to 50, like, because there's just a lot of silver in the world.
And that doesn't mean that, that happens instantly. Like that junk silver that you're talking about takes time to get through refining and stuff like that. But those processes do exist to bring more silver online. Granted, we all understand the idea of a production deficit that somehow has existed for years upon years, but doesn't materially affect the price. And it's always the conspiracy of the bankers holding it down, right?
Yeah, let me give you a bit of a preview of something we're working on. It probably published around the time this podcast comes out. Our February doom zoom is on copper. It's titled "Copper Emerging Super Cycle or Mostly Hype," and we try to give it a fair, balanced view. Copper basics: what's the bull case? What's the bear case? Or deconstructing the bull case. And I won't spoil the conclusions, but we did a deep dive because copper now is starting to have that silver feel, right? There's a huge subset of investors, many of them in Canada, who just want to be long resource stocks, you know? Like, and I understand it, and I think it arises from a desire to own something tangible. So they're not going to buy Tesla and Nvidia because they think those are fake or phony or overvalued, but this copper mine that may or may not get developed is a real thing. I could take a plane and go see it, right? And they want to own those things. And so, and we happen to have a lot of such people as subscribers, and so I'm sensitive to that. Appreciate their business, thank you very much. And we used to be that way, and we've come to the conclusion that gold is the only thing worth owning, to satisfy that must be real tangible itch. So we'll walk through copper and show people how we think about it. And we haven't written much about copper, but that's something to look for under the Doomberg masthead for our pro tier. Our February Doom Zoom is going to be on copper.
Excellent. Duberg, I want to kind of circle back as we wrap up here to the idea of AI. And obviously, this is an unanswerable question, but what do you think the effects of AI are going to be on innovations like, or AI applications on things like energy specifically, like fusion AI, hydrogen? Any other, massive groundbreaking inventions or step change unlocks in our ability to produce energy more efficiently and more cheaply?
Yeah, look, the human endeavor is infinite compute. That's one of our operating mental models. The long-term real price of all commodities is lower, especially the energy commodities. That is being driven by grinding deflationary force of technology. And AI is the next tool or iteration in the technological development that will grind down the price of oil and gas and copper and silver, especially in ounces of gold or in real dollars, however you wish to correct for debasement. And yeah, AI is going to lead to a deluge of new primary energy. Because that's what the human endeavor is. The single greatest bet anybody can make is on the up and to the right line of global energy consumption. And any company that unlocks that, debottlenecks that, enables ever higher volumes of energy production will be rewarded. And AI is being rapidly integrated into the search for, development of, and logistics of bringing primary energy to market, both to feed AI and because that's just what humans do. And yeah, that this is again one of the reasons why, being long oil or copper or wheat or corn, can make, in our view, little in the way of sense, at least long term. You don't want to get in on them on a trade, sure, but these things go lower. It's like owning the VIX.
Or there's a leveraged VIX vehicle that has this time decay to it that is just amazing to see that grind lower.
Yeah, exactly. Or go plot UNG, the natural gas futures, and plot the 5-year chart.
Doomberg, it's always a real pleasure to, do the research leading up to our conversations, making me think a little bit differently. Of course, for anybody that found value in this, go give Doomberg a view at least, if not a subscription over at doomberg.substack.com. It's always a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much for your time.
Tom, it's great. Congrats on the new show, and may you have all the success you so richly deserve.
Thank you very much. Always appreciated.